You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Very special episode today. I'm a huge horror fan, Ryan. You know that.
I know.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. And
huge.
I got to work with this guy in a movie called Urban Legend, which many of you probably didn't see. But my dog dies. They put it in the microwave in the movie. Real dark stuff.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but it was great working with him. He was really fun. We got to do a little Fangoria magazine interview. Robert Englund, of course. Freddy Krueger. This is a great interview. I really was waiting for this one. I tried to get him for a long time, and he finally came around. Maybe he didn't know, you know.
Who's to say?
You just got vaccinated.
I did. I got my second vax.
Second vax. So we could hug soon.
We can. 2 weeks.
2 weeks, you'll hug me.
I will.
Guys, you need to watch this podcast just to see us hug on the show. Couple reminders. First of all, thank you for subscribing and listening to the show. And if you're here to listen to Robert Englund, you're a big horror fan, I would really hope that you would give the show a chance and subscribe. You could subscribe at Ryan. Well, you can go to YouTube and you can subscribe. Type Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum and subscribe there. You can watch the interviews, or you can go to Spotify or Apple or whatever, write a review, subscribe.
Right.
And the handles are
at Inside of You Pod on Twitter, at Inside of You Podcast on Instagram and Facebook.
Yes, there you go.
I might still be a little brain foggy.
Yeah, I'm a little brain foggy too. I'll tell you what. We watched, I've been really getting into these UFOs, the UFO thing. You know, I watched the Bob Lazar documentary on Netflix. It's free. I watched it's called The Phenomenon, which is one of the best documentaries about UFOs and the military and the government hiding all this shit. And, unacknowledged, and read some stuff and listened to the Joe Rogan interview, and check it out. There's some stuff going on. I think I think everybody at this point knows that there's probably, we're not the only ones in this vast universe.
Yeah.
So just check it out. Anyway, look guys, we're doing another show, Sunspin, my band, the last Saturday of every month. And it is the 29th, I believe, in May. Two shows, 2 p.m., 6 p.m. Just go to sunspin.com. You can get merch. You could book Zooms with us. You could book the band. And you could also get tickets to the show, which is May 29th. And we're really loving it. Check us out on Spotify, too, and Apple, wherever you want to look. But we're all over the place. Our new album, we're really excited about it. And also, if you want to get any merch for Inside of You, the podcast, if you're digging to go to Inside of You online store, you can get Lex Luthor stuff and Inside of You stuff. And there's just so much goodness. There's only, I think, a couple lunchboxes left.
Uh-oh.
Smallville lunchboxes.
Better get on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's have a code. Let's have a discount code for the Inside of You online store.
Okay.
Let's call it UFO15. 15% Jesus off Christ. Everything in the store. UFO15.
Oh my God.
You're going to watch these documentaries. I'm going to make you watch them. So you're going to go, you know what? I know what you're talking about.
Look, I believe that aliens exist. The rabbit hole is too deep to go down for me to feel any kind of sanity about it. Like it's,
I said the same thing. And then I start watching the stuff and I go,
I don't.
Why is it so crazy to think that some ship, you know, that goes light years ahead of us, the speed at which these crafts go, somehow, whether it broke down, whether it had difficulties, whether it came into our realm, our universe, and crashed, what's so crazy about that? And then they've got this technological advances and, you know, that we can't even understand that. Just, and then for years we're trying to catch up. That's as simple as that.
It's just because there are so many other issues in the world to fix. This one just feels like a.
But this could fix it. This could fix so much.
I mean, I don't know.
I have a theory. I'm not going to talk about it. Anyway, thank you guys so much for subscribing. I love my patrons. You know I do. It means the world to me that you listen to the podcast. Thank you, Westwood One. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Bryce. If you want to write in, hello at Inside of You Podcast. I don't always write back, but I do read the messages, and I thank you for them. And, that's about it. Why don't we get inside of Robert Englund?
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
In
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Well, what a treat. I get to talk to Nancy England.
Oh, yes. The infamous Nancy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how many times have you said, why did you marry a woman named Nancy?
We get so much fan mail about that. And she's sort of cut from the same bolt of cloth as Heather.
Well, but the joke is that he looked really hard for a Nancy.
Right.
I bet you get, there's so many questions you probably get just so tired of. And I was thinking, okay, let me put myself in Robert's shoes here, because, you know, I played a villain for a long time, and, you know, people would always say, look, Luther. In fact, I had a guy come over and redo my wall in the podcast room. And he's like, he's this Hispanic guy and a great guy. He's like, Mr. Luther.
Señor Luther.
Yeah. He's like, actually, he called me Mr. Luthor. And I go, it's actually Luther.
Luther.
Yes. But I mean, do you go through stages of, like, in the beginning, you're like excited. And then you're like, all right, that's not the only thing I do. I mean, and then you go, what the hell? I embrace this. This is amazing. I'm lucky to be. Did you go through stages like that of, like, people going, hey, Freddie? And you're like, fuck you.
Well, you know, Michael, I always thought of you as a comedian. And then you had this great success playing a villain, you know, so I can kind of flip this question back to you. But for me, I was lucky. I had the whole 70s playing best friends,
right,
and sidekicks. And then towards the end, I was everybody's favorite redneck.
Yep.
You know, White Trash Robert England. And so I'd already been established in Hollyweird.
Yep.
And knew who I was. And when I did V and then Freddie, it just banged me into international actor overnight, you know. Mm. And I said, I'd never had that kind of success before. And I see, it was like grabbing the ring on the merry-go-round, you know. I got it. I just hung on.
Yeah, because you had done, you're classically trained. You've done a bunch of shit before that. So
I didn't have it. You don't have anything to prove. You know, I understudied Iago with a great actor playing Othello, Roger Robinson, the late Roger Robinson, who did a lot of the August Wilson plays. I think he won a Tony Award for one of them. But I've done a lot of stuff, but I did it in that moment of time, you know, when you're not on, you know, Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood,
right,
on the cover of People magazine because you're starring in some play in the Midwest with Michael Moriarty, original Law and Order. But, you know, it's, so I had that kind of under my belt.
Right.
And I kind of proved to myself, you know, that I could do that stuff. And then the first 10 years in Hollywood, you know, my God, I hit my marks with Jeff Bridges and Barbara Streisand and Burt Reynolds and Charles Bronson, Susan Sarandon. I had a partial nude scene with Susan Sarandon.
What do you mean partial? Where you're at? Was,
well,
it,
Susan was topless.
Well, what about you?
No, I was playing the bashful sidekick.
Oh, okay.
And so I got to be bashful and sensitive. And Susan had to unbutton her blouse and flash me.
Have you ever bared ass?
In 1975. That's Rocky Horror Show era.
Right.
Humana, humana, humana.
Yeah. Did you ever bare ass or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Recently, too. I'm old and, you know, my testicles are down around my kneecaps.
Come on.
Yeah, no, Fear Clinic. I had to run around naked in Fear Clinic. So, and be this old scientist, you know, so that was kind of embarrassing.
Wait a minute. You showed your junk.
Well, I mean, I could see it when I go from like a kind of samadhi tank, you know, one of those kind of like hot tubs, sensory deprivation hot tubs. And they put a towel around me and march me across. But, you know, I went to dailies. I saw the pelotas.
You're like, somebody's going to take this. Some little assistant's going to just take a picture of your junk and it's going to be everywhere.
What was that magazine? Celebrity Skin, remember?
Yep, I do.
Well, back in the day, don't you remember you and me and Jonathan Silverman back in the 1960s hanging out with Hugh Hefner at the Playboy Mansion?
Oh,
getting
yeah.
Our pictures in Celebrity Skin. I think Silverman was dating a couple of girls from Petticoat Junction.
Jesus, you really are aging him there. Is he that old, old Silverman?
I'm just kidding.
I know.
I'm being a general.
Right.
Keeping it general here.
Well, listen, were your parents when you were growing up? Because, look, first of all, I want to say I love you. I've always loved you. You were an idol of mine. And, you know, working with you in Urban Legend and just being in the trailer. And I remember when Fangoria magazine came to interview us. And I just was on cloud nine. It was my first big movie, really, with a big part. And we just really hit it off. And I just always admired you and looked up to you. And we got along so fondly that it was just you made it so easy for everybody around you because you are a legend. And even at that time,
you ordered breakfast at craft service one day at the window. I think we had really good craft service, like some fabulous lesbians from Vancouver who were making us great, you know, granola with a lot of brown sugar and syrup and stuff. And I remember you ordering as Christopher Walken one day.
I'll take eggs
from then on.
I'll take eggs, silver easy. Scrambled, Robert, England's with a U. It's not an A. It's not Land. It's Lund.
Lund. He's Swedish.
He's Swedish. You are Swedish.
Ow.
But
ow.
But
ow.
I just. Wow.
Everything I can do. Ow.
Ow. You just. Everything's. It's relaxed. And you know what's funny is I ended up working with him like 2 years later.
I know.
And he was.
I saw you after that. I asked you what that. Dueling Watkins.
Yeah, Dueling Watkins. He was kind of weirded out by me, but because I was so, you know, you get that bright eyed kind of young guy looking at him going, and he's like, oh great, another fanboy. But he was cool. But you know, when I met you, you were so humble. We had such a good time, and that was really a good time shooting Urban Legend.
It was a great cast. I mean, you know, I've had a little crush on Alicia Witt my entire career. I remember her on the old Sybil Shepherd show. Say that 10 times fast. But I mean, you know, Jared Leto, pre-Oscar. Yeah.
Josh Jackson. You
know, I think the unsung acting in that movie, I mean, Loretta Devine, Brad Dourif, but the unsung performance in that movie. Rebecca Gayheart's great in that movie.
Yeah, she did a great job. Villain. What about the guy? What about the professor? Remember, he was from X-Files?
I had lunch, the John Neville.
John Neville.
I had, when I was a Rada boy, and I was all patches on my sleeves, you know, and talking like Madonna in London, Royal Academy brat. We studied some of those performances, and John Neville had done Othello on the West End with Richard Burton when the entire audience was teenage girls because Burton was so beautiful, you know, with his strategic acne scars and that beautiful voice that sounded like silver thunder. And they would all do the matinees. The girls, the teenage girls would all ditch school, go to the matinees to see Burton. And Neville and Burton would swap roles. One night he'd play Othello in blackface, politically incorrect.
Jesus.
And then the next night he'd play Iago. So I go out to lunch in downtown Toronto at this elegant old restaurant with John Neville. And of course, I know all this shit. So I start asking him these questions. And no one's asked him these questions in 50 years. So it's little Robert England, you know, sitting there. You know, but I, you know, I've got my little goatee and my George Clooney haircut, and I'm being a subtle fanboy with John Neville, but he loved it. So I got all this gossip, you know, about Judi Dench and about Richard Burton.
Give me something that nobody knows.
Judi Dench apparently was wild, and Helen Mirren. He said Helen Mirren every time she got on stage, she had to take her clothes off. You know, she always wanted to do a nude scene back then.
Helen Mirren always wanted to be naked.
Apparently, that's what he says. That's what Neville told me. He goes, Helen, she'd do King Lear naked if she could. Apparently, she had a lot of nude scenes at the old, but when you're naked at the Old Vic or the Royal Shakespeare Company, that's really something, you know.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty amazing. I remember.
John Neville was great.
I remember that one line. I just always remember it goes, The Weeknd. The Weeknd.
If you IMBD him, it's amazing.
Oh yeah, he's done everything.
To see the stuff he did. I think he was sort of the new John Gielgud. I think that's sort of how
I could see that. Yeah. Hey, when you were a kid and you were born in Glendale, I didn't know you were born in Glendale.
I was born up in the foothills there. You know, there's that place. There's a kind of a weird area where Hollywood and Atwater Village.
Yep.
And Grand Boulevard. It's sort of like Los Feliz hits Glendale. And there's some foothills going up. And I was born at a hospital in those foothills, but I almost immediately became a valley boy. I grew up almost until I was 18. I was in the valley. I was a valley boy. And I lived in Encino and Sherman Oaks and Woodland Hills and Northridge. And I lived for a while on that street right down the block from Clark Gable. So when I was like a little kid going to the market with my mom, Clark Gable would be in there, you know, in the butcher department.
Did you always want to do it? Act?
I remember the moment. I was supposed to be a lawyer, but I remember the moment I was dragged off to a professional children's theater workshop. And I was with this older girl who was the hottest girl in the valley. And that's saying something. That's a pretty high bar, you know. And she later became a talk show host in Puerto Rico. And she was a wannabe actress. And I figured I'd just be, you know, sweeping backstage and ushering or something. I got all the lead roles. I was Pinocchio. I was Peter Pan. I was Aladdin. I was Hansel and Gretel. And I also got laid for the first time. I was 12 years old.
With her? With the Puerto Rican? No.
It was all I remember was there was a sweatshirt that said Bloomington, Indiana on it. It was kids from all over the country. So it was some bad girl from Bloomington, Indiana.
How old were you when you got laid?
12 and a half, yeah.
Wait, how old?
My summer of 12 and a half. I didn't have penetration sex for a long time after that. But yeah, I lost my dick at 12 and a half.
12 and a half? I didn't have hair on my balls till I was 18.
I didn't either. And I was probably the worst piece of ass in the world, you know. talk about premature ejaculation. But
ejaculation.
You know, and I had curlers in my hair. Spoolies. They had curlers in my hair. The girl had put... If my hair was supposed to be curly for one of the roles I was playing. Yeah.
That's ridiculous. That is absolutely wonderfully ridiculous.
A hair dryer fetish now.
Were your parents, were they always supportive of what you were doing and just like, I love you, Robert. You can't go wrong with us. Did you have a good support system?
They farmed me out to the children's theater. So I blame them kind of. But then later on, they sort of thought I would change my tune and stick with law because I was an athlete and because I was, you know, national thespian guy and because I had good grades, I was sort of fast tracked maybe to they invited me up to Stanford, you know, for a meet, you know, that thing you do in your senior year, you go to a college.
Right.
And I went up there and I was a pretty hardcore surfer. And the one thing we hated were Speedos. You know, you had to have surf board shorts, not Speedos.
Thank God.
I went up to Stanford and all the frat boys were from all over the country. And it was the first sunny day up in Palo Alto. And they all had their Speedos on and they were laying out in the lawn outside the frat houses, rubbing each other with baby oil to get a suntan because everybody liked to be tan back then. We didn't know about skin cancer. And it creeped me out. So I said, nah. So I went to Cal State, Northridge, and UCLA for a while, you know. I just stayed close to home.
But they were always like, whatever you want to do, we love you. Like, did you get like a lot of love as a kid?
Yeah, I had a great upbringing. I mean, you know, I look back and it was like really encouraged and let me alone. And also that kind of freedom, you know, there was my generation, we had tons of freedom. You know, you're mom or your dad would whistle for you for dinner. You know,
yeah, I remember that.
7 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And until you were just out in the neighborhood and you could tell who was cool by where people's bicycles were in the driveways. Because in those days, nobody parked in driveways. You had to use the garage, you know, and the streets were for kids.
Yeah.
And orange groves and the beach, you know, was for kids, you know.
I experienced that in the 80s. It was just a freedom of like, be home by 10. They didn't know where you were. If you wanted to go see someone at the movie theater, you go, I'll meet you there at 7 and just hope they're there.
Yeah. Well, you also learned a kind of social interaction and how to survive. And it was weird, like at strange points during your childhood, remember when cool kids kind of were nice to you the first time, you know, or let you come over and hang, their parents were out of town or something, or you get to go swim in their pool or their mom would drop you off at the beach, you know, drop you off at Malibu and leave you there all day. And so those moments of time, I think, are real important because if you're not out on your own, you're not able to kind of negotiate that kind of social demarcation that exists in society.
Yeah, I think that's really nice. You know, I look at your career and you've done so much. I look at TV. I look at the movies. I look at all these things. When, you know, your parents are seeing success and they're seeing
original Charlie's Angels.
You did Charlie's Angels?
How long I've been around? Yeah.
Jesus. Well, I mean, that's not that old. That's,
my first film job is 73, but my professional debut was 68.
How old were you?
20.
21. Now, your parents, when you did, now your parents no longer with you?
They've been gone for a while, yeah.
You know, I wonder, they see all these roles. They got to experience a lot of your success, right?
Yeah, my mom wasn't around for a lot of Freddie, but the very beginning of Freddie. But my dad's great moment was I was working and I couldn't go to the premiere of my first movie because I was out killing Burt Reynolds in another movie. And so my dad went to my premiere, movie directed by Dan Petrie, the whitest guy in the world, Canadian director, great director, who directed, among other things, the original Raisin in the Sun. You know, and I mean, that cast is who's who of great black actors. But I didn't get to go to the premiere, and the after party was at Chasen's. And my dad got to go.
Wow.
And he was with Pamela Sue Martin and Jan Michael Vincent. They took care of him. And my dad got to go to the after party at Chasen's. And my dad's a martini guy. And Chasen's is famous for like the best martini in the world. My dad had been there before, but not a lot. So my dad loved that. My dad kind of knew I had arrived because he got to go to the after party at Chasen's. And I had single, you know, the first time you get single card
at your own table.
My first movie, I got single card.
Single card and at the you know, you have your own table at the party if there's a, you know.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Fourth billing. And so my dad kind of got it then. And I was Bobby England, Robbie England for my whole life. And I used Robert England. And that my dad really made my dad feel good because that's what my dad would call me when he was pissed at me. You
know? But what was it like? He was like, Robert, get your ass in here. 12 and a half years old laying pipe.
Robert,
what are you doing?
Schwinn out of the driveway.
But like, you know, I have to say, like when I first got Smallville, when they first saw it, that was the first time they were like, oh, you're on a successful show. Like I had done a lot of things that weren't successful, but that was, you know, but this was the biggest thing. This was like, holy shit. So Nightmare
Now International too.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, you know, it was like everybody was like, "Wait a minute, it's not just another independent film or a little." You know, my dad always said, "What are you doing? I'm doing this movie. When's it going to be in theaters?" Well, it's independent. Oh, so it's not real. No, it could become a movie.
Man, can you go to Utah?
Yeah, it always just somehow lessened. It made me feel lesser than I was. But we won't get into that. But you know, but I wonder. When they first saw Nightmare on Elm Street and they saw you as not playing the buddy, not playing these, you know, the plays and all that stuff was great. And they're like, this guy, our son's talented. But when they saw you as this come to life, this larger than life character, did your mom or dad ever just say, wow, Robert, did they ever have that moment?
They never saw me on stage, professionally, which was a great disappointment because I had a couple of big successes on stage. But Johnny Carson, I think, did a Freddy Krueger joke, or Dick Cavett or somebody did
right.
a Freddy Krueger joke, and they heard that, and I'd sort of entered the popular culture by then. And there was also in the Sunday Funnies, one of the cartoonists in the Sunday papers had done a Freddy Krueger thing, and that's actually what sort of relaxed them, you know.
Wow.
But I had also done V.
V was a big show. I loved V.
Elm Street. And it was a miniseries.
Yep.
And it was a big event. And it had this really rare advertising campaign, like Rosemary's Baby. When I was in college in UCLA hanging out, all over the streets of Westwood, there were stencils that said, pray for Rosemary's Baby, and fake graffiti that said, pray for Rosemary's Baby. So we were all anticipating it. If you hadn't read the book by Ira Levin, you know, you were, what is this Rosemary's Baby? It's coming. Or you just see an entire billboard and it was just a baby's bassinet, you know, or a baby carriage.
Yeah, creepy.
And so they did the same thing with V. They did fake graffiti, like dripping graffiti, like graffiti had been
a big V, right?
A big V, and it was dripping. like red spray paint everywhere, all over America on billboards. And my parents saw that, and I had already told them I was doing it. So they knew that was sort of like, oh, you know. And also, and you know this, I mean, because you've done a lot of independence, you get that TV money, that first TV check, you forget. That's where the bucks are.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
TV and syndication, yeah. That's where you make your money. That's how you buy your first house.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it, you know, getting those first checks from V. You know, that was like, whoa, you know, after a month, you know, you've got six figures in the bank. You can't believe it, you know.
And that was Mark Singer, right, V?
Mark and Faye Grant. And I saw Faye Grant singing in the rain on Broadway. She's so good. Yeah, a lot of people. Michael Ironside, the great Michael Ironside.
Yeah.
Within that. Yeah, it was fun. Huge cast. Michael Wright. Just terrific actors. Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean,
We got those guys that became ILM, John Dykstra from Star Wars. And they came over and did our effects. And so the special effects on V were what really raised the bar for special effects on television. You look back at it now and it looks kind of like cheesy CGI, but back then it was state of the art.
Right.
And really, but before V, it was just somebody running around in green makeup chasing William Shatner.
Inside of You is brought to you by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. This is an amazing platform. I use it on both podcasts. It has worked wonders for me. It's so amazing how easy it is to navigate. If you want to sell products, t-shirts, soap scents, whatever it is, Ryan, you want to sell, this is the way to do it. You could see what your best seller is right there, analytics, how much you're making this month, what products are selling the best. It's really fantastic. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million order stage, Shopify's there to help you grow.
Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered.
Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star.
Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way.
Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/inside, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/inside now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/inside. Inside of You is brought to you by Netflix. Battle Creek, Michigan, 1963. Kellogg's and Post, sworn cereal rivals, race to create a pastry that will change the face of breakfast forever. A wildly imaginative tale of ambition, betrayal, and menacing milkmen, sweetened with artificial ingredients. Unfrosted stars Jerry Seinfeld in his directorial debut. It features a supporting cast of comedy greats, including Melissa McCarthy, Jim Gaffigan, Hugh Grant, Amy Schumer, Max Greenfield, Christian Slater, Sarah Cooper, Bill Burr, and many more. Friday, May 3rd, only on Netflix. You know, you said something about Star Wars, the Star Wars guy. Did you audition for Star Wars?
You know, it's this internet.
They throw that out there.
Well, it's the internet screws up. It's like that Dixie cup with a string in it. The way they kind of obstruct the truth. No, I have a great once upon a time in Hollywood story that I tell at conventions. And it got turned into Robert Englund was up for Star Wars. I wanted to go in and audition for the Frederick Forrest role in Apocalypse Now, the chef.
Cookie. Right.
I was too young and Freddie Forrest was under contract to Zoetrope. But I got in for the surfer. Because I had done Big Wednesday, because I surf. So they brought me in for the surfer. They thought I was a little bit too old. I had kind of, you know, stubbly beard, but I was buff. I was tan. I was surfing. I had long blonde hair, and I was wearing kind of military thrift shop outfit. Apocalypse Now, right? I think I even had a pair of fake dog tags on, my shirt unbuttoned, long blonde curly hair. And Fred Roos or somebody walked me across the hall from the Apocalypse Now audition, which I did not get. They said, you know, you might be right for something here. And they brought me over to the Star Wars audition. And I don't even think it was called Star Wars then. And they took my Polaroid, like a mugshot, you know, profile and full face. And I think it was for the Han Solo role. I think they didn't know how to go with it. Originally, they were thinking of an older uncle, the kind of guy that brings a joint to Thanksgiving and gets all the kids high, you know, the cool older uncle. And I think they even offered it to Tom Selleck, I think I heard. Ooh. And he turned them down or something. I don't know. But anyway.
He turned it down for a reverse mortgage.
Back in the day, little Annie's husband passed away. She loved her house, though. She didn't want to lose her house. Anyway, I've been around the block. This ain't my first rodeo. Anyway, I go across the hall, and I'm just excited because I love George Lucas. American Graffiti, THX 138. I love George Lucas. I go across the hall. I take my Polaroid, maybe for Han Solo. But I notice the sides for Luke Skywalker because the name. It's such a great name, Luke Skywalker. And I looked at the sides. I can't remember if I stole them or not. I went across the street to the Formosa. So now you know where I am.
Oh, yeah.
Had a couple of Bushmills. Jumped in my old 2000 Datsun. Not year 2000, cubic inches. And I went back to my place in Laurel Canyon. And I look outside. There's a pair of old beat-up Fry boots in front of my front door, which means, it's Mark Hamill, because we would take off our shoes. I had nice carpeting in my lair up in Laurel Canyon. And Mark was on my couch watching the Bob Newhart show. We would watch Bob Newhart and Mary Tyler Moore because we hadn't watched the originals. Then we'd call our agents. And I walked in the door and I said, hey, Mark, you know, George Lucas is doing another movie and you might be right for this. So my Once Upon a Time in Hollywood story is that Freddy Krueger told Luke Skywalker to call his agent, and he got the part. You know, he got in there and got the part. Now, his agent hates me telling this story because she swears that she already had submitted him. But I don't know.
Of course.
This is before your time. But in the 70s, you were either movies or you were TV. You didn't go back and forth until Travolta.
Oh, yeah.
Until Welcome Back, Kotter. And then he went into
Saturday Night Fever. Right.
That was a big shift. You were either a movie guy or a TV guy, and your agents had power accordingly, you know, to that.
And even then it was tough. Even after that, it didn't really start to happen until really in 2000s, like, you know.
It was tricky. I mean, you were either a TV actor or you were a movie actor. It was very different. Yeah.
Wow. What a great story. So you and Mark Hamill were close.
Mark was turned me on to the Kinks. He turned me on to Lenny Bruce, all the Lenny Bruce albums, Lord Buckley. But best of all was Monty Python. And we had all the albums. And I did for like a year. I didn't realize they performed that stuff, actually performed it as sketch comedy. I just thought they were like BBC radio voices. And we would lay on our backs, you know, and look at the ceiling in my apartment and just play the albums over and over again and try to memorize the routines. We love Monty Python. Mark Hamill in real life is just really, really quick, really funny.
He is.
You know, he works a little blue, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's different than you think, you know, because he was so good looking. He was always sort of like leading man.
Yeah.
But he's actually, I think, a character actor. I know a lot of people are like that. Richard Gere is maybe, you know, he's such a good looking guy, but he might actually really be a character actor in a leading man's body. I think it happens occasionally to some of these guys.
Did you have where, you know, you and Mark are good friends and then, because this happens all the time, he goes off to do Star Wars, he becomes a big star, and then you don't hear from him again?
No, Mark came back and told us all the stories.
Did he say, this is going to suck? Wait.
Yeah, no, Mark knew, because Mark's a fanboy. You know, Mark had a letter in Famous Monsters magazine as a child. You know, I think he was a military brat. And Mark knew that it was going to be huge. And he told me, you know, Alec Guinness stories. And I think he had a crush on Carrie Fisher. And no, Mark and I were friends after that for a while. What changed was I moved. I moved to Santa Monica. I had some money after, I think it was after Stay Hungry. And we moved to Santa Monica, or I moved some, Mark moved to Malibu and I moved to Hancock Park. And we just didn't see each other as much anymore. Mark got married. And that's sort of like when we did, I would see him occasionally at, you know, like Comic-Con down in San Diego or something. Right.
And Star Wars was 78, 76?
I think so, yeah. 77, 78, yeah.
And Nightmare on Elm Street was what, 80?
84, yeah. I was doing my Henry Fonda movie then.
Right.
Right around then, yeah.
Did you, when you auditioned, do you remember the scene you auditioned for Freddie?
It was a meet. I didn't read.
You met with Wes?
Nope, it was a meet, and it was, I think it was in North Hollywood, but it might have been at the studio, the old Desilu studio on Cahuenga. But I was like surfing then. When I wasn't acting, I was just surfing. So I was really, really tan, and I had really long blonde hair, and my hair is kind of fine and thin. And I remember greasing my hair back using some oil under the hood of my car. And I've told this story a million times. So I'm sorry if I'm boring anyone.
No, I haven't heard it.
But I also use cigarette ash under my eyes. It's an old makeup theater trick. It looks very real. You can make your eyes look real heroin chic, kind of junky. You can sink your eyes a bit. And to kind of counteract my healthy Malibu tan. And I grease my hair back, and you can kind of see through my hair to see my skull a little bit because my hair was greased and slicked back. And my hairline's high anyway. And I went in and I just remember, keep your mouth shut, Robert. Keep your mouth shut. And I played staring games with Wes. I tried not to blink. You know, that old thing when you're a kid, you don't try not to blink. Who can go longest without blinking? And Wes was the raconteur. Wes was telling me all of his ideas about the movie and what it meant and how it would be. And I listened and absorbed that, but I kind of posed a little bit. I kind of sucked my cheeks in, and I kind of made my eyes a little bit psycho. And I think that's how I got the part. But Annette Bening, I don't know if you went up for National Lampoon movies or stuff with Annette Bening, but Annette Bening, I had just been up for National Lampoon's Class Reunion. Every role in the movie, I tested with everybody. Annie Potts, I tested with everybody. And I didn't get it. I kind of canceled myself out with my being too versatile or something. I don't know. But Annette felt bad about that. And I think Annette was really my champion and convinced Wes.
Annette Bening.
Not Annette, Annette Benson.
Benson, Jesus Christ. I was like, Annette Bening?
No, Annette Benson. Not Annette Bening, not the actress.
Okay.
That's me. That's a mind fart. I apologize.
Everybody's like,
I apologize to both of them. No, Annette Benson. Was the casting director. She did a lot. She's quite famous. And I think she really fought for me. But there's another theory that I have a real skinny kind of hatchet face. And they were very worried. Bob Shea, head of New Line, Wes Craven, they were all worried. David Miller, the makeup effects guy, about when you put makeup on somebody, a lot of times if they have a big head, and a lot of people in film have big heads because it looks great on film. Small people with big heads. You know what I'm talking about.
I have a big head. Thank you.
You put makeup on them, prosthetics, then their heads really look big, especially if they don't have broad shoulders.
Right.
Well, I'm 5'10 and I've got reasonably broad shoulders, so I could take the prosthetics without it looking out of ratio to the rest of my body. And I think it could have been as simple as that, although I hadn't done any tests or anything. They may have just been able to tell by the way I looked.
Did you think you were going to like, oh, they're going to fire me once they see makeup on? There's always this actor thought of like, they're going to fire me once. No?
No. You know, it was a strange thing. I kind of owned it quick. I mean, Wes didn't give me much direction from after about the first couple of days. I just sort of got it. He knew, I knew that Freddie exists in a dream. So it's a little larger than life. You're dreaming Freddie. He's not walking around in an alley sharing a cigarette with you behind the Formosa. Freddy's in your dream. So it's slightly exaggerated. You know, Freddy could break into song and dance if he wanted to. And he kind of knows your subconscious. He's kind of in there looking in your underwear drawer of your subconscious and knowing what makes you tick. So I kind of got that right away. And Wes just sort of left me alone, and he liked the way I physicalized it. And I was sort of set free. I had done like a year and a half straight of television. And you know, Michael, how many times at the end of the day they light you for 45 minutes and stick you in a corner and you just have to listen to somebody else's monologue.
Right.
And they just need, they're going to only use 3 seconds of that.
Yeah.
But you stand there for a half hour trying to look cool, you know? And, you know, I was so freed from that, wearing the makeup and getting to physicalize. I felt very liberated. I was able to move more, kind of dance the guy.
Yeah. What was your first line that you remember? And you didn't, you're like, how am I going to deliver this? What am I, did you know, did you rehearse it a million times in front of the mirror?
No, you know, I found the voice putting the makeup on.
Really? Yeah. That's when you found the voice.
Yeah. And I think the first line I had was just saying the name of the girl, Tina. And I think I did it a lot of different ways, but I wanted to do it with a whisper. Tina! You know, I had this idea of it as a whisper, dot, 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 you know. I could sort of see it mentally. And I think that was my first line. Though I found the voice sitting out in the valley, deep valley, you know, borderline Pacoima, North Hollywood. And I was in a garage at David Miller, the great David Miller's makeup shop, and in an old vintage 1950s, 1940s barber chair in front of the mirrors. And maybe this was the second or third time we did a makeup test. And David wasn't real, his hygiene with his brushes wasn't real good. Oh. And they would get kind of stiff and crusty, you know, like day old snot. And he was kind of like touching me up because Wes or Bob Shea or both of them were coming over to look at the makeup and give him notes. And he was kind of stabbing me with his crusty brush. And I think I went something like, God damn it, David. And I saw myself say, God damn it, David, in the mirror. And the reason I said that was I was a little hoarse or something, or I hadn't had my morning coffee. And I went, oh, hey, I kind of like that. That gutturally plays voice work.
Wow.
Character. So I had the voice from that yelling at David Miller one day, you know.
That is.
You know, Freddie's talking like this. I'm saying, hey, what are we going to, you know, and he's trying to, he wants to listen to heavy metal music in the morning, and I want to watch the Today Show. Let's watch the Today Show. You know, I like that Jane Pauley. Hey, you know, and that's my voice, you know, surfing USA, Robert England from the Valley.
Right.
And I can't use my broader voice. My long vowels don't work at all. So I found that voice yelling and scolding David Miller at like 8 a.m. somewhere, you know, in East Bumfuck, North Hollywood. You know, in a garage, Jesus, in a barber's chair, but it was seeing it come out of that face in the mirror.
God damn it, David. I just love that.
God damn it, David. God damn it, David.
Wait a minute. Thank you, David. What? You're fucked. You're crazy. I know.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I watched the documentary. It was like a, I don't know, an 8-part, whatever series of the whole Nightmare on Elm Street. And I watched it, and it was just like, you know, they kind of let you run free after a while because you would come up with all the stuff. I mean, a lot of those things you were, you know, like welcome to prime time, bitch, was your line, right?
That's, yeah, but I, in all fairness to the writers, and there's some great writers. It's like who's who, guy that wrote Shawshank Redemption. You know, we have great writers on the show, Force Majeure, a lot of great people. And of course, Wes, Brian Hegeland, you know, but you know what happens, you know, in Smallville. About halfway through season two, maybe sooner for you, Michael, but about halfway through season two, you know, you have your house directors on a series, and then you have, you know, because of the DGA, you have to have new directors every so many episodes. And, you know, every once in a while you get a new director and he's probably not a real big Superboy fan.
Right.
You know, he likes Terrence Malick. He wants to follow Lex Luthor with a handheld steady cam between his legs, walking, you know, up the stairs. And they don't, that's not something, he's not paying attention to the plot. He doesn't know who you really like and who you don't like. And he makes you stand next to somebody you don't like, or he wants you to do something a piece of business with a prop that you know, as Michael Rosenbaum, you know he wouldn't do that. Lex Luthor wouldn't drink a beer out of a bottle. You know?
Right, right.
That's not Lex Luthor. He drinks, you know, 25-year-old scotch out of crystal.
Right.
And you just know that about the character. Well, you own it. There comes a point where even you know more than the writers about the do's and don'ts of Lex Luthor. And then the same thing happened with me with Freddie. There comes a point where I just sort of owned him, you know. Rennie Harlan, the director Rennie Harlan, who really let me alone on part four. And that's my favorite performance of Freddie, because he really let me kind of dance the character a bit, you know.
Right.
Really make him reptilian, kind of wear the furniture.
Yeah, I mean, you could just tell you were having more and more fun. I remember the audience, even during the whole run of all the movies, I remember forcing my mom. Well, I didn't force my mom. She loved horror movies and got me to watch horror movies with her when I was 8. So that's why I'm kind of fucked up. But we're watching the one where I believe it's Dream Warriors. And I remember somebody in the audience just jumped up and goes, "That's Freddy's mama." Helena Kruger. And I remember going, wow, man, people are excited about this movie still.
Well, you know, there's a great happy accident. And I'm sure it's happened to you with some cult films. Video for me would have been DVD for you, Michael. But I came of my career came of age during the video revolution. So I had hit movies in the theaters, and then they became hit films again when they came out in video to a whole other audience.
Yep.
But I had that times 8. And that's not counting the TV series. And not only do I have that times 8, but then I have it again with DVD and Blu-ray and cable and marathons on cable. So you get a new generation.
Yeah.
I'm on my third generation of fans.
So what you're saying is you're rich. And
the movie had a 20-year run. It was 84 to 94. And then 10 years went away. And then we did Freddy versus Jason. And that revived. That revived it again for a new generation. So we actually had a 20-year run, 8 movies, a television series.
Jesus, man.
And DVD and videos. And then the videos became the making of, and then the DVDs became Blu-ray, you know, and they became more sophisticated. Now, people aren't doing that anymore, but now people, I went looking like on the subset of menus on a streaming app the other day. And I couldn't believe it. There was like a Robert Englund section, you know, of just horror movies. You know, like, what?
How cool
stuff
is that?
I forgot I'd done, you know, in Europe, you know.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Macy's, Adidas, Walmart, Nike, Wine.com, Samsung, Lenovo, Sephora, and more. And even stack sales on top of cashback. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of 3 pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
After the first one, is, you know, didn't they try to cast another actor as Freddy Krueger? Now, this would have just pissed me off, lack of respect. Did they try? Because I know Wes didn't direct the second one. I know there, but the fact that they did they not ask you to do the second one, or that you wanted to?
Well, you know, they asked me to do it. And now I've heard there was a money thing, But I never remember. I don't remember there being a money thing. I just remember there being a scheduling thing. And because I had agreed on the money, or my agent had agreed on the money, he made demands with them about the scheduling. And so they were going to use a double for me for a scene in a steam room. So they used a double for me, and I was supposed to start the next day. And I literally remember being in makeup late in the day, like 2 p.m. And they had finished with the second day of using this double. And the director, Jack Shoulder, had gone to Bob Shea and the people and said, we got to reshoot this stuff with Robert. It's horrible. This guy's walking around like Frankenstein. Ooh, you know, and it's like, we got to do it, Robert. He goes, you don't know. And so I really have to thank Jack Shoulder for stopping shooting while I was getting makeup in the makeup trailer. When I finally was scheduled, I'd finished whatever else I was doing, some other movie. And they brought me in, and they were already a couple of days into the shooting of the boys at the high school, and brought me in, and I was there getting my makeup. I think it was my one and only late call for makeup I had up until that point. Normally I'm there at the crack of dawn. And I think I saw the other guy for a minute. I saw them. They had a mask on him or something. I don't even know if they had the right makeup on him because they hadn't designed any for him. And Kevin Yeager was the makeup guy for part two. The great Kevin Yeager produced Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah.
Created Chucky and everything else. And Kevin Yeager, you know, was there putting on my makeup, and he prepared it. So obviously we'd made the deal because he'd had to do the molds and everything, or he'd gotten the molds from David Miller and had done all the sculpting on the prosthetic pieces. And it was finer and thinner. I remember, I don't quite remember going to Kevin's shop, but perhaps I did before that. Maybe I did go to Kevin's shop and do a test, but there had been that delay in scheduling. But I really have Jack Shoulder to thank for being the guy, you know, the director of part two, saying, you got to use Robert. There's nobody else.
So there was no discrepancy. There was no not ever thinking of not casting you in the second one because of money or anything like that.
Well, they offered me. I was offered the part, and I don't think it was money because I remember I was still, perhaps I had just finished V the second, or I was still doing the series of V, or I had just finished the series of V, and we were all sitting around with our fingers crossed that it would be picked up. And I had renegotiated, and that's where I was that's where I was making my big bucks.
Right.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
But you should have been.
It was quite easy for me to say, oh, they're offering, you know, this amount. Fine. I'll do it. You know, but they have to wait till I'm done with the last episode of V. Cause then I'll be on hold for V, waiting to hear if I'm picked up, and we'll fit in Nightmare on Elm Street. And they were kind of uppity about that.
But why would
that was the problem?
Yeah, but Robert, I feel like I know I would have been, and anybody out listening would have been like, I'm Freddy fucking Krueger. That movie was, I'm Fred Krueger here. So you have to pay up.
Michael, you have to understand, back then, my head was in V. V was my international success. They were flying me over to Italy for award shows. I think I'd already done one movie in Europe, which I love. I love working in Europe, in Spain or somewhere. And I love playing Freddy, and I knew Freddy was a hit, but there was only one Freddy. And it had just begun to take off huge internationally. And because this would have been 85.
Right.
And my head was not just in the Freddy Krueger playbook. I was still hoping I'd get picked up for V because then I would be rich.
Right.
I would have been rich. And so I wasn't thinking about negotiating. My agent was just trying to, I think, clear the schedule, make this schedule.
Gotcha.
Work,
okay.
And not demand a bunch of money. That just wasn't where my head was at. Again, I'll tell you, at the end of Nightmare 2, the one we're talking about, I had to do pickup shots in a little MTV studio on Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood. And I think I had to, like, you know, peer around a door, or they saw my shadow, maybe a shot moving up my legs, and you saw me from down, just a couple of atmosphere pickup shots. And Wes Craven loaned them the original glove for the pickup shots. And I went over there, and I had been told by somebody at Fango, to watch out for industrial espionage of fanboys who were going to try to steal some props at this shoot. And we realized there were a couple of guys there on the crew that weren't really on the crew. And the reason we ID'd them was because they had brand new tool belts from Walmart. Brand new, you know, that new kind of Timberland leather, that bright orangey leather, you know?
Yeah.
You can tell, you know, that, you know, like when you go to school the first day after Christmas, the guy that has all the new clothes on, you know, you can tell.
He wasn't ripped.
Yeah. Everything, all the tools were shiny and new, you know, he didn't have them in the right loops. So we kind of figured out who these guys were. So I took the glove. I took the original glove and I just gave it to my agent as a present, you know, because I didn't think this Nightmare on Elm Street thing was going to be that big. I figured, hey, I did two of them, you know, it's helping me overseas. Great. You know, I hadn't made a lot of money. I thought I was going to be a TV star back then. I thought, oh, I'm going to be the new Dr. Spock or something.
Right.
Because of me. And the next thing I know, you know, I've got first class tickets to Paris and first class tickets to Hong Kong and all that stuff.
Wow.
It kind of changed overnight for me. And then by the time 3 came, I couldn't control it. By the time Nightmare 3 came around, which was, I think, is the biggest hit of all of them. That's
yeah.
The one with Patricia Arquette.
That's my favorite. The original's my favorite. Then 3, I would say, is my second favorite.
3 is the fan favorite. Yeah, 3 is definitely the fan
favorite. It's just the kids and you. It just
love Wes Craven's New Nightmare the best. But
oh, yeah. That's fantastic.
That's real kind of deconstructed, you know. It's kind of meta,
yeah,
know, and fun.
What did you, you know, a lot of people, I know you've heard this a million times and you could like denounce it or whatever, but you know, they say that the second film, you know, when you watch it, there's a lot of, you know, undertones. There are sexual, what's the proper terminology here?
Well, there's a subtext. Let's call it like it is. There's the homosexual subtext of part two. The gay subtext is that Freddy is playing with the two boys. He's in their subconscious, Mark Patton and Robert Russler. Freddy's in their heads. They're having Freddy nightmares. So he's playing with them. He's toying with their adolescent hormones and any latent homosexuality that might be present in either of them. So that's there. We played with that. And Freddy plays with it. There's a scene where I circle the boy's mouth with my blade and practically French kiss him.
Right.
And I remember talking to Mark and going, Mark, I'm going to make this real darkly erotic here. We were on top of it. Jack was so busy worrying about the effects and the money and that constantly tick-tock clock going, you know, when you're shooting, that Jack doesn't remember, you know, that we played with that. But I know Mark and I talked about it. I think Robert Russler and I talked
about it. But Bob Shea, I think on the interviews, he would say like, no, I don't remember anything like that. I think he was one.
Bob doesn't remember talking about it because we were so worried about, you know, getting, you know, we shot in Pasadena. If you know anything about shooting in Pasadena, you got to have everything rolled up and out of town by 10:30 at night or though, you know, it's a huge fine.
Right.
So they had a lot of pressure on them. But Bob Shea plays an S&M bartender. In the S&M gay bar scene.
No, that's right. The professor of the movie. Guys.
So there's definitely, it's not, you know, there's, and we, right away, you know, I was getting all this fan mail from kids that loved, you know, and Mark Patton was getting
sure.
all this fan mail from boys and girls that were saying, we liked seeing ourselves, you know, we're troubled and all of that and confusing and, you know. And it, so we played it. It was just one more element.
Yeah.
To sink your teeth into.
It's amazing.
It's not what the movie's about, but it is a subtext in the movie.
It's amazing that I, as a kid, when I watched it, it, you know, it scared the shit out of me and I didn't recognize any of that. And then when I watched it as an adult, I go, oh my gosh, look at the door. It says, keep out the boys.
If you watch any of them, there's sexual stuff in all of them.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Freddy, you know, there's a Beauty and the Beast sexuality hidden there. That's
right.
Always part of it. But it's not, you know, the thing that people get wrong is imagining that Freddy's a pedophile. No, 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 no. Freddy's a child killer. You want to think of that poetically, darkly poetic, like
right.
like a Doors song, you know, Jim Morrison's classic cover of Child Killer, you know, Alice Cooper, Child Killer, you know, or somebody. It's that darkly, Child Killer has a thing to it. He's killing the future. Children of the future. He's killing the future. There's something dark and William Blake and creepy and dark about that. You know, so he's killing kids. He doesn't need to rape them. You know,
right.
Isn't that bad enough that he's killing them?
Yeah, yeah, that's bad enough. By the way, your energy, it's like I'm back on set on Urban Legend with you. You just have that lovable, fun, you know, just you're a great storyteller, and I appreciate
it. I'm a fan too. You know, we talk about, I mean, I remember you and I bonded over movies we loved back
then. Oh, yeah. Remember? Oh, yeah. And I want to bond with you again. We gotta catch up for real. I mean, this is enormous for me. I love this. I've always wanted to have you, and the fans, my patrons out there, they're going to love this. By the way, this is called Shit Talking with Robert Englund. And this is rapid fire. So you answer these real quick from fans.
Okay.
Rapid fire. Taylor K., what was the most difficult scene to film in the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise?
Probably the demon, Freddy, in Freddy versus Jason. I'm a little over the hill when I did that movie. I had to do my sit-ups every morning and eat my yogurt and my gluten-free. That's really me underwater in that movie. And that's me coming out.
Wow.
And landing on the deck of the pier. But I couldn't get that makeup off because they double glued me on the demon makeup. And they were worried that I'd leak like an old condom, you know, and I'd look like a water balloon or something after one take. So they double glued me and we couldn't get that off. And it took hours to get
claustrophobic.
They scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed. And by then I'm raw. And I had to go back to work the next morning at dawn to put the traditional Freddy makeup on. And that was a bitch of a week. Thank God I had a break coming up on Friday.
Steph A., as the king of nightmares, have you ever had a real nightmare that scared you?
Yeah. I have one for years when I was a child. And I had it into adolescence where it's sort of Pork Chop Hill meets Manchurian Candidate. You know, the traditional Korean War. The Korean soldier, North Korean soldier, they have that hat, you know, with the flaps pinned up and the red star. So that scared me to death. It's a Cold War fear, I guess, from watching the news or something. But I'm on a playground. I'm a child. I'm in elementary school. And I'm in the lap of the most beautiful girl in the sixth grade. And I'm dying. And she's caressing me. And blood's coming out of the corner of my mouth. And over the fence of the playground are all of these North Korean soldiers with guns and fur coats and those hats with the red star and the ear flaps pinned up coming at me. And I don't know what it's from or where it's from, but I had that probably until I was 20 years old.
Don't eat before you go to bed.
And I wrote about it in my book and I mentioned the girl's name. And about 5 years ago, I got an email from her. This girl from my sixth grade class.
Wow.
What does it mean?
I don't know, man. That's a dream. I swear to God, I'm not even being weird, but I had a dream that you came over my house instead of Zoom me and you were in makeup, but it was really bad makeup. And I'm like, well, you know, you don't have to be in makeup for the interview. And then you're like, no, it's fine. It's fine. And you're looking at my shit and it was just weird. I don't know. Anyway, Carly T, you have played Freddy across various platforms. What's your favorite version of Freddy to play? You said the fourth one. Do you like the movie?
Yeah, Nightmare 4, the one Rennie Harlan directed. He let me kind of physicalize it and dance him a little more in that.
Right.
And I really like my performance in that one.
Lauren W., do you still have the iconic red and blue sweater? No way.
No way. No, I gave it to Planet Hollywood for their big opening.
And they shut down.
It must be in Bruce Willis's attic now.
Or his ass.
Somewhere in Idaho.
Little Lisa, what was your favorite part about working on Urban Legend besides working with me?
Well, I did like those lunches with Baron Munchausen, you know, with John Neville.
John Neville.
Those were fun. Plus, I got to act with Alicia Witt, and I've had such a crush on
you.
Alicia.
Have. Does Nancy know this?
I don't know. You
she
know
does now.
Late in life, I got a little tingle for redheads. I never had it, but now I'll be flipping around the TV. I see an old Rhonda Fleming movie, and I get a hard on. I mean, I don't understand. Just late in life, redheads.
Well, Rusky S. Rusky. Speaking of Rusky, old Rusky over there. Rusky S. Did you ad lib any of the great one liners? He already told us his story. But what's your favorite one liner?
Well, I like Welcome to Prime Time, bitch. But there's one in Freddy versus Jason where he says, "Don't worry, princess. The first time tends to get a little messy."
I remember that. Good God. Leanne P., I love your portrayal of Willie in one of my all-time favorite miniseries, V, of course. Any fun memories you'd like to share from behind the scenes?
Well, you know, I'm always brokenhearted that we got prematurely canceled when we turned to series. One night we were working on the back lot at Warner Brothers, and we had trash barrels with little fires in them, kind of like a homeless encampment. And we were all sitting around warming our hands and doing this scene. And I went over and I saw the dailies the next day. And it was nighttime and we're all lit underneath with the flames. And I said, this is what the show should look like. Because they tried to play the normalcy of the Earth being kind of invaded and held captive by these aliens. And I love the idea of the underground and the rebels kind of having to like live by their wits and living underground. And this idea of like these sort of like homeless camps and the fires in trash cans and skulking around at night. I went, oh my God, this was probably halfway into the series. You know, it costs nothing. You just shoot nights and make it look. Now we've seen that post-apocalyptic look on everything.
Right.
Now we're sick to death of that. But back then in the early 80s, this was a great look. And we could have embraced that, I think, along with the leftover John Dykstra creations. And it would have been a better look for the series.
Lisa H., what was it like working with Andrew Dice Clay in The Adventures of Ford Fairlane? Your character in that movie made her laugh out loud.
Hello, hello, hello. Snapper. Andrew used to call me Snapperhead.
Hey, Snapperhead. Hey, what are you doing?
Andrew, you know, I used to go to a market, my first gourmet market, Chalet Gourmet on the corner of Sunset Boulevard in Fairfax. And I almost scratched Andrew's Cadillac opening the door there once. And Andrew went off on me in character. You know, he was smoking a cigarette in the parking lot. And then cut to years later, I'm working with Andrew. And he remembered it, you know. And he was really sweet. You know, he kind of apologized. He said, I was in a bad mood. I just lost a part. But I remember when Andrew bought his first, his first house. And he was signing the papers in his dressing room. And he was nervous. He was like a big kid. You know, he really is a teddy bear in real life. But, you know, I remember Nora Dunn, you know.
Oh, yeah, Saturday Night Live.
And complaining about him. And we, you as a comic and me as an actor, knowing other actors' source material, I always knew that he was doing a little bit of Buddy Love and a little bit of Fonzarelli, you know. He was doing a little bit of Lords of Flatbush. He was doing Joey Buttafuoco.
Yeah.
He was doing those Long Island guys. You and I know that. And for her not to see that and to think that was Andrew, you know, it kind of broke my heart that it took the wind out of his career for a while. But he's had the last laugh, said that HBO show, did that great Woody Allen movie with Cate Blanchett.
I remember he cried on Arsenio Hall, I think it was. He was like, you know, people, you know, they think that I'm this way. He starts talking about that. But he had the best one-liners. This guy in the audience was hecking, we don't need people like you. Get out of here. And he just looks and goes, why don't you turn your teeth around and bite your throat? Do us all a favor, you fuck. And he goes, hey, you're the look at you. You're the type of guy that gets out of the shower to take a piss. I just loved him.
A sweet guy.
He didn't mean that shit. He was just
working.
He was a character.
He didn't pull any star shit at all on Ford Fairlane. That, you know, that movie didn't do that well when it came out, but now it's, and you know, you've had some like this too. It's great. It's full-fledged cult classic now.
Yeah. Hey, lastly,
cast, Gilbert Gottfried, you know, Vince Neil from Motley Crue. I mean, everybody and their dog is in that. I remember being in the Capitol Records building, sitting with Priscilla Presley and Wayne Newton.
Jesus.
And he had the left-handed Stratocaster of Jimi Hendrix. And Wayne Newton is a huge rock encyclopedia. He knows everything about rock and roll. Everybody. He's met everybody. He's Mr. Las Vegas. And he was telling stories about Elvis and literally playing chords on the Jimi Hendrix Stratocaster. And he and Priscilla are old friends. And, you know, it's like you're like, whoa. And then we went to roast Joel Silver in Vegas at a roast. And I got to walk through the casino with the king of Las Vegas's wife, Priscilla Presley, on one hand, and Wayne Newton, Mr. Las Vegas, on the other. And the casino parted like the Red Sea,
wow.
You know, in the Ten Commandments. And people came up and they had, you know, Priscilla kiss their dice, you know. Not Andrew Dice Clay, but, you know, their dice for craps.
Yeah.
And they also had, you know, they just wanted to touch them for good luck. And that was all because, you know, of Andrew Dice Clay and his movie. Joel Silver produced it, you know.
Wow.
Rennie Harlan also directed that, guy that directed Part 4. But that was just a really fun gig. I did all my own stunts on that, too. That's me on the sinking boat, you know. It's yours truly.
I love it. Hey, let me ask you last before we go. This shouldn't be the last question, but... You know, I worked with Wes. We did a movie that nobody saw really called Cursed. And I really loved him. He sent me a letter before I worked with him. I still have the letter about just saying, I love your work and I'd love for you to come and join us. And it was just, but when he passed away, it broke my heart. I felt so horrible about it. But I know that you knew him for so many years. Were you guys close and how did it affect you?
We were close and we had mutual respect. You know, Wes is a double threat, writer, director, which you always feel comfortable with that. And I did a series for Wes up in Vancouver. We were watching SNL one night. I had the best apartment up by Stanley Park because I might walk my dog in Stanley Park. And we were watching SNL, and it was the night of the Head Wound Harry sketch with Dana. And Wes and myself, my wife, a couple of the actors from the show were all sitting around drinking a bottle of wine, and Headroom Harry came on, and Wes is very tall, you know, and Wes is sitting on my couch, and Wes almost fell off the couch laughing. He was laughing so hard he was crying, and he turned into the 14-year-old boy that is Wes.
Aww.
Loving that dark, funny, tricky humor that Head Wound Harry was. And I mean, I had to like slap him on the back because he was laughing so hard. We thought he was going to choke. And Les had let down his hair, so to speak, in front of me that night, gotten a little drunk, you know, and laughed until he was crying at that sketch. And I think that was kind of my gift from Wes, that he finally became one of the guys with Ball. Instead of just my boss, you know, he was one of the guys finally.
That's amazing. Yeah, I remember he used to always have me do impressions for takes, and the cast they were just like, so they had to redo this movie Curse. So they redid it. They wanted him to reshoot it, which he was so pissed off about it. And the actors had to come back, but they recast a couple actors, and he asked me, and you know, it wasn't even a huge part, but I just wanted to work with Wes. I just didn't care. And every day he would just have me, Michael, do it like Walken, do it like Malkovich, do it like, and the cast was like tired, but they were like kind of trying to be nice. But I'm like, are you sure? He's like, yes.
Yeah.
And so I was barely in the movie. And then when we had a rap party on the video, I was like 80% of it. And I'm a guy that worked like 6 days on the movie. And he was just so, at the end of it, we used to talk about Amityville Horror. He goes, it was a hoax. I'm like, no, it wasn't. We would talk about it right up till we're shooting, and we would, just that he was so fun to be around. And at the end, I go, Wes, he goes, Michael, I go, it's great working with you. He's like, my pleasure. It was a real pleasure. And I go, I'm going to give you a hug now. He goes, are you sure? And I go, if you don't mind, he goes, okay. We gave each other this nice hug. And it was just, he's one of those guys where you want him to like you. You just, he's such a good spirit to be around.
Two things that a lot of people don't know. I don't know if you ever went up to his house. He had the coolest bachelor pad in all of LA. He lived in Steve McQueen's old bachelor pad.
Wow.
And he'd retooled it. He had an exercise pool, and everything in it was cool. Every coffee table book, every CD lying around, the art on the walls. It was just the coolest place, right on a cliff, way up Nichols Canyon, overlooking, you could see Catalina Island. So there's that part of Wes. He also, when I first met him at his first house down in Venice, he had some great cars, his original XKE, you know, Peter O'Toole, Audrey Hepburn, you know, How to Steal a Million, XKE in his garage. But there's also the Wes Craven that as a child was not allowed, you know, to read comic books or go to movies or watch TV. He could only see like a couple of Disney movies a year. So Wes was always kind of catching up. You could always turn Wes on to some movie or you know, some horror movie, great classic, or something kind of grindhouse, Quentin Tarantino-esque, or something like that, because he sort of missed that as a child because his parents wouldn't let he and his brother see that stuff.
Wow. Yeah,
you so can, he had you, hunger. Yeah. He had that hunger and that curiosity. And I think he also, because of that, he sort of kept the 14-year-old boy alive in him.
Yeah. Hey, I love you. It's so great to see you and hear from you. And thank you for being on the podcast.
My pleasure, Michael. Hey, be careful out there. All right. We'll all see each other at a con soon.
I love that interview. I really enjoy. He's just so open. And I think, you know, when you play a character for so long, you know, you can get tired of the same old questions. And yeah, I try to mix it up, but it's so iconic. And, you know, my friends and I, we actually sat down and watched all the Nightmare on Elm Streets.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was a good time. It was a good time. They're not all good. I'll tell you that.
Well, there's a lot of them. They can't all be.
Yeah, no, they can't be. There's a couple of them that I really liked, but Dream Warriors was my favorite. The first one, Dream Warriors, was really good. But thank you, Robert Englund, for coming on the podcast. It meant a lot to me, and I consider you an old friend. And yeah, if you enjoyed that, stick around. Please subscribe to the podcast. Take a listen for next week's episode. It's going to be another goodie. And yeah, thank you to all the patrons. Again, if you want to follow us on socials.
At Inside of You Pod on in Twitter. No, not Inside of You Podcast on Instagram and Facebook.
At Inside of You Pod on Twitter and at Inside of You Podcast on Instagram.
That's right.
And Facebook. And then if you want to watch on YouTube, just type in Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. You could watch the interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we do these cool animations.
The one that came out of
with Kiefer,
that was
Kiefer
really
Sutherland
good.
And
really good one.
Jason Patrick. They really did a great job.
And that's on your Instagram.
And that's on my Instagram. You can go to The Real. No, it's just The Michael Rosenbaum on Instagram. But thank you to everybody. Remember Sunspin. Go to sunspin.com for all band updates. You want to book a Zoom with us. You want to book the band. You want to get merch. You want to go to a Sunspin, listen to a Sunspin show or watch it on Stage It on May 29th, 2 p.m., 6 p.m. We'd love the support. If you haven't, we'd really love to see you there and see your name pop up, and I'll give you a shout out. And if you want to join Patreon, with many other people, it's become a nice family. Please do so at patreon.com/insideofyou. Mm-hmm. And join us, and I'll give you a nice text right after. And it's there's a lot of fun stuff on the Patreon. If you don't know what it is, check it out. Go to patreon.com/insideofyou, and you could learn, because it will show you what different tiers get, and again, you know, boxes for me and messages and this and that. And it's a lot of fun. But right now, one of my favorite parts of the podcast is the end of the podcast, which I get to give all the shout outs to the patrons, and we get to see how many names Ryan knows.
Yeah.
Here we go. Nancy.
D.
Mary.
B.
Leah.
S.
Trisha.
F.
Sarah.
V.
Little.
Lisa.
U.
Kiko.
Jill.
E.
Brian.
H.
Lauren.
G.
Nico.
P.
Robin.
S.
Jerry.
W.
Robert.
W.
No. Gosh, you
no,
just
it's Robert L.
No, it's Robert B.
Robert B. It's Robert
Did you,
B. That's
you guys got to give it up. Right into Ryan. What's your Twitter?
At Tez Ryan.
At Tez Ryan. At T-E-L-L-E-Z Ryan. And give him a shout out for, it's pretty amazing that he could do this. We got Jason W. We got Apotheon. We got Kristen K. Amelia O. Allison L. Lucas M. Raj C. Joshua D. Emily S. CJ.
P.
Samantha.
M.
Jennifer.
N.
Jackie.
P.
Stacy.
L.
Carly.
P.
H. Wow, you're baffling me. Carly S, Jen S, Jamal F, Janelle B, Carrie B, Tabitha 272, not to be confused with
Tabitha 273,
Ashley Ryan, Kimberly E, Mike E, Marissa
N,
Nani Arello, Eldon Supremo, 99 more, Ramiro, Santiago M, Sarah F, Chad W, Leon P, Ray
H,
A,
oh, that's A first,
Maya
P,
Maddie
S,
Kendrick
F.
Dude, how are you doing this?
Because I've done 60 of these.
Ashley.
E, sure.
Shannon D, Matt W, Belinda N, Kevin V, James R, Chris H, Dave H, Samantha S, Spider-Man,
Chase,
Sheila
G,
Ray
H,
Tabitha
T,
Tom
N,
yes, Suzanne
P,
B. Damn. Katie.
I don't know this
one. F. Liliana A. Michelle K. Hannah B. Michael S. Talia M. Luke H. Andrew T. Betsy D. Claire M. Liz J. Laura L. Chad L. Rochelle E. Final stretch. Uh-huh. Nathan.
I don't know.
E. Brandel. Taylor K. Neil A. Marion A. Meg K. Janelle P. Trav L. Dan N. Jennifer J. Wayne M. Diane R. O.
Jetta.
Lorraine G. Olga
K. Oh, wait, no, that's a person I know.
C. Corey M. Carrie H. Veronica K. Big Stevie W. Kendall T. Lindsay M. Carol D. Katie G. We got Sandy B. Angel M. Eric C. Rhiannon C. Stephen M. Corey K. Super Sam. Super Sam. Emily K, Sherry S, Coleman G, Michelle A, and Riley J. It means the world that you guys are my top tiers and that you listen to the show and subscribe and all that stuff. And I would not be able to do this without you. That's a fact. I've told you before. Thanks for subscribing. I love you. From Ryan Taez
and Michael Rosenbaum
up here in the hills of Hollywood.
Hollywood, California.
Hey, everybody. It's Harry Carey here. And we're going to wave to the camera, Ryan. Hey, guys, thank you for allowing me to be inside of each and every one of you. I hope you have a glorious week, and thank you for allowing me to be a part of your life every day, or at least once a week when you listen to the podcast. So take care of yourselves. Be good to yourselves. Be good to others, and much love.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.